This episode is presented by Invest Puerto Rico. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Hello and welcome back to Equity, a podcast about the business of startups where we unpack the numbers and the nuance behind the headlines. Today is March 15th, 2024. I am joined today by my dear friend, co-host of the Found Podcast, Venture Desk reporter, general bon vivant. It's Becca Skutek. Hey, Beck, how you doing?
I am doing well. Loving this beautiful spring weather that we're having here. How about you?
Dude, we took the kid for a bike ride. I'm wearing shorts. I know people are like, don't talk about the weather. But after a hellaciously long winter, in my view, I'm so glad that things are blooming. The sun is out. I feel like a new person, frankly.
No, I agree. I'm like a plant. If I'm outside for like 15 minutes, my like leaves look healthy. I feel invigorated. Like, this is what fuels me this time of year.
I hate to admit it, but that's so dead on. Like, every time we get to the depths of winter, I just slowly turn into a couch monster and wrap myself in more and more blankets and don't move. But we do have someone to thank for today's excellent weather, which is Marianne, because it's her birthday week. And so this must be a gift from her to us so we can have a lovely show. She is, of course, off this week, but back next week. But before we get into the show rundown and talk about everything else, we do have a request for everyone listening. If you have a minute and you listen to Equity, please drop us a review or a star ranking on whatever podcast app you use. It helps us quite a lot. And also, Becca, while we're here, you have a podcast.
Yeah, if any of our listeners are longtime listeners of Found, and if you're not, you definitely should check it out if you like Equity. There's a lot of overlap that I think people would like. We interview startup founders. It's a good time. We have some really fun episodes that we just recorded this week coming out soon. So if you listen and like, maybe drop us a little love as well.
Yes, it is support your favorite podcast season. Anyways, on the show today, we are going to talk about a couple of legal updates on TikTok and then what's going on with AI in the EU. Then for deals of the week, we're talking about Peak XV and also Ada Ventures. Going to be quite a lot of fun. And then AI and privacy, and then IPOs not coming back in 2024, but Becca had some good news for both founders and investors alike, so stick around for the end of the show. All right, first up, the House passed a bill this week that would force the divestment or the ban of TikTok here in the US. Rebecca, I'm very curious, what's your take on this situation? Because I have a perspective, but I want to know what you're thinking.
It's one of those weird scenarios where I find myself agreeing with people I don't generally agree with on this topic. And kind of like the meme, like, wow, the worst person you know just made a good point. Like,
yes.
I do agree that if we sort of take this hard ban here in the US, one, everyone's saying like, well, nothing happened when Facebook did all these things. Nothing happened when Twitter did all these things. Like, I completely agree with those people. This feels like a weird precedence based on, you know, information that could be true, could be bad. I'm not diminishing that. That definitely could be true.
I'm kind of on the other side of this one. The argument that we shouldn't ban TikTok because other companies have been fast and loose with data, to me, doesn't quite hold up, because I don't think that's the chief concern here. It's not like company is not behaving the way regulators or the market thinks it should. It's more a question of foreign ownership and how we set the rules for our national marketplace. And to me, reciprocity is pretty important. And if you do go to China, where ByteDance is based, which owns TikTok, and try to load Facebook or Twitter, or pick your favorite Western social media service, you can't, because it's banned. So I'm also very sympathetic to your view here, just to be clear. I don't like the precedent much, but extreme cases make for odd edge moments. So that's kind of where I stand. But it doesn't matter what we think, because it's up to the Senate to do what they will, and then it's over to the president. But it's not the only bit of regulation out there. The EU is taking a victory lap for a comprehensive AI regulation. American VCs are making fun of them. What's your take?
You know what's interesting? I think, well, VCs are making fun of AI or these regulations now. I think I was talking to some investors earlier this year about just investing in Europe in general, and they were saying that regulations are a little harsher here than they typically are in the US, but they're much more clear in areas like AI, also in areas like blockchain. And I know like Andreessen Horowitz just opened a London office that is mainly focusing on blockchain investments, because it's like, even if the rules and regulations, which I'm sure is very similar in this case with this AI regulation, even if that means maybe the limit isn't as big, you're also not in as much risk of getting in trouble.
Right.
Which is big as far as like a risk reward. I mean, it adds to the pros and cons list, which every investor does every time they're looking at a potential investment. So just things being clear so people don't get bit down the line is always a good thing.
Yeah, there's two ways to regulate. You can regulate as fast as you can and try to get it right, or you can wait and then regulate later. The US tends to let business run ahead and then we come up with rules down the road. The EU is trying to do the opposite of that. Though with AI moving so fast, we'll see how the regulations land. Of course, there is Mistral AI over in France and a number of other large AI companies in the area, so we'll see how they react. But all that's preamble, just news to keep y'all up to date. The first real story for the show today is Peak 15, or as I call it by accident, Peak XV. Becca, this is the kind of India-focused spin-out from Sequoia when it broke into small parts. And the news from our own Manish Singh is that it's going to launch a perpetual fund backed by its own partners. And my understanding here is that this is not a replacement for its traditional venture capital funds, but more a pool of capital from its own investors, employees, and so forth that it can use to either invest into its own funds or other companies. News, of course, here's a little bit scarce, but Becca, first thoughts.
I also just think it was a good sign. I remember when I was reading the story initially, some of the reports out of the Indian startup ecosystem over the last few years haven't been particularly negative. It's like funding has dropped. And then, of course, we're seeing what's happening with like Baiju's. Like, that's obviously not a positive story for everyone to latch onto about how that market is going. So seeing this and being like, okay, these VCs not only are going to continue to raise LP capital, but they also want to do this separate vehicle so they can do more investing into the ecosystem. That one both said to me that they're trying to invest in things that their LPs aren't going to want them to, which I kind of love that off the bat. And two, it just means that there's an appetite there. There's enough stuff that justifies doing this now, especially even though it hasn't been that long since they spun off from Sequoia. And so I just thought this is such a very positive signal for that ecosystem in general. What did you think?
Well, you don't get a bigger plate if you're not really excited about the buffet, yeah. Right? So in this case, a larger vehicle means they have more miles to drive, and that means more deals to do. Ergo, enough cool stuff is happening, which makes sense to me, just given how big, just looking at India itself, the population is, how digitized it's becoming. I mean, oh my gosh, if you're an entrepreneur, what a, you know, fertile place to go try to build. So if you're an investor, it makes sense to me to have a lot of capital on hand. Also, I just like to see slight variations in kind of the venture model. I think people are probably pretty aware that general partners in a fund at a firm do put some of their own capital into it, but it's not that much. It's kind of almost a symbolic skin in the game point for a lot of folks, especially if they don't have tons of cash. But in this case, this feels like that times 10. And that's bold in a way that does seem slightly out of the ordinary and therefore cool. So I actually asked our own Manish Singh, who wrote this article, for a couple of things that really stood out to him. And I'm just going to go ahead and quote from him because he was kind enough to type me up a whole paragraph. So from Manish to your ears. It's very interesting that Peak 15 is planning to become a, quote, significant LP in its own funds. Obviously, partners and GPs everywhere tend to make a single digit contribution to their funds, but you don't see a firm launch a whole new fund for it and take such an institutional approach. Hard agree there. Definitely something that is new. One thing, though, we don't know exactly where the capital is coming from, if it's coming from the balance sheet, from incoming fee incomes. Not entirely clear. Of course, we broke this news, so the actual PR isn't out yet, but I'd love to learn more. So if you don't read Manish, you really got it, because his reporting on venture capital in India is just fucking great.
Mm-hmm. And the only other thing I'd add to is that evergreen funds in general, I'm curious if we're going to see more kind of after what we've seen over the last few years in the venture market. So many funds got burned by 2021. And in one hand, sure, you can blame them for prices they're paying or sort of the deals they were doing. But on the other hand, funds have specific timelines where they need to deploy capital. So boohoo for you if your vintage makes you deploy into that kind of a market. There's nothing you can do about that. Like, sure, you can go back to your LPs. Sure, you can extend. But like, it's not as easy as an evergreen fund where you can just be like, cool, we do one deal this year. Valuations cool down. We do four deals this year. It's like, I like the evergreen structure. And I am curious if we will see more people move in that direction if they can, because the market really has burned a lot of people over the last few years, more so than they even know at this point.
Yeah. So if you're listening to what Rebecca just said, and you're thinking to yourself, why do they have timelines? That seems to be an artificial way to go about making money. Well, it's because companies actually used to go public. And so a 10-year fund was sufficient time to do deals and see those companies exit, generate liquidity, return capital, and then you do it all over again. Things have changed in that front. A lot of companies just haven't gone public. But I do think now the math is a little bit harder to square up. So this sort of evolution could be the future. Evergreen or not, I don't know. But back me up here. Didn't Benchmark kind of move to mostly investing its own general partners' capital in its funds? Or am I making that up in my brain?
Benchmark? trick? I'm not sure. But the one fun that comes to mind for this is Homebrew. Homebrew does this.
That, and that's a more recent decision by Hunter Walk and Satya Patel. All right, let's move on and talk about a different venture capital firm, one that we haven't talked about much on Equity historically, though we have touched them a little bit this week. Ada Ventures, $80 million fund. Talk to us.
Yeah. So Ada Ventures pulled in $80 million, like you just said, for their second fund. It's a fund over based in London, and it's woman-led, and it invests both in diverse founders, but also in tech that helps push inclusivity and diversity, which is a really cool, both a really cool thesis, but also it's just another example. I was literally just talking to someone yesterday who is saying, oh, fundraising is going to be tough this year for firms in 2024. And he was like, oh yeah, emerging managers, like emerging managers just dead. I'm like, dead as if. So it's always fun to get more examples, especially in this case, because reading through our colleague Mike Butcher's story about the fund, they held a first close just in October on a little over half, so 44.7 million. And now they close the whole 80 million. That's a pretty quick fundraise in any market that isn't 2021.
Super fast.
So that not only says that emerging managers are definitely not dead, but these kind of strategies where you are still focusing on diverse founders or founders from underrepresented backgrounds or tech that is, you know, triple bottom line, trying to do good as well as produce profits and ROI back, is this is a great sign.
Okay, but could this be the exception proving the rule? Like, are we seeing other firms that are relatively nascent get to their second fund as frequently? I don't have data on that, but it doesn't feel like I've seen tons of that news. So I wonder if Ada Ventures is just particularly strong, perhaps on its pedigree from the last fund, or just has a really great thesis that people are excited about. I want to take it as a positive sign, but I just feel like I'm still skeptical a little bit about how much capital VCs are going to raise this year, given the deceleration we saw in new LP commits in calendar 23, which was pretty extreme, frankly.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I don't think we're going to see a lot of positive fundraising news this year. I was just talking to an LP on Monday, and he was saying that a lot of the funds they had traditionally backed were kind of waiting till 2024 to go out and market. And he was saying that they're going to have to go out and market this year. But with that being said, he doesn't think the fundraising environment will actually be any better this year. So it might actually be worse for people who go out to fundraise in 2024. The other thing here, too, that's worth pointing out is that I would love to know their LP mix. I know Mike Butcher listed a few things in the article, including like the British Business Bank, which is a huge venture LP over there. But I'm curious if there's any US LPs, because from chatting with people a couple months ago, US investors are really bullish on getting into early stage European deals. But US managers that haven't been there traditionally for a long time kind of struggled to do that. So I am definitely curious if some of this is driven by just appetite from US LPs to get into that European market.
That would be fascinating if that is the case. If only we had global rules demanding more LP transparency from pooled venture capital funds.
If only.
That would be nice. Imagine the things we would know and be able to tell our fine friends who are tuned in. If you're an investor and you're listening to this, yeah, be more transparent there. I feel like it's fair to founders to know where the money they're taking comes from originally. But also it would help us understand, you know, just the global flows of money, period, which I think would make us all smarter. One last thing about this, though. There's been this rejoinder to the idea of building for inclusivity, for building for diversity, call it the anti-DEI push, if you will. That, to me, makes the Ada Ventures Fund just that much more outstanding, literally, because I just didn't expect to see this.
No, you're totally right. And I just covered Black Tech Nation Ventures a couple of weeks ago. They raised their debut fund of $50 million, and they had told me that they started raising in 2021. People were still pushing inverse investing in diverse-led funds, diverse-led managers, because of what happened with George Floyd, sort of the reckoning the country went through in 2020. They said they raised half the fund in like 6 months, and then it took them 2 years to close the rest of the fund. So it's people are still backing this area. People are still committed to these strategies, even though there has been some like social pushback, which, I mean, it's good to see funds focused in this area. One, be able to raise the capital, and two, be undeterred.
Yes, but it has given me a really great rule of thumb, which is if you say the words woke mob, I won't have lunch with you.
I mean,
just saves a lot of time.
That feels like the bar is on the floor.
The bar is on the floor. I'm just saying if you trip on it, it's not my fault. All right. We have to take a really short break, but when we come back, we're talking about AI and also the future of startup liquidity. What's next in tech? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual, Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/TechCrunch. So, Becca, I know because you're sitting here on the podcast with me today, you are not at South by Southwest. And I have to say, high fives to us for not being cool enough to still go. But I'm curious if you did catch the news item about what we saw regarding AI sentiment at South by this year.
I did see a little bit about this. This was interesting, one, because some of this came out of talk by the Daniels, who are currently the what my alumni is using to shop around for school donations. So I always am very supportive of the Daniels. But yeah, I'm not surprised people in that industry are a little weary of AI. I mean, it practically caught, it wasn't the only reason, of course, but like, it was a big reason in why the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild went on strike last year. I mean, people really care about this stuff.
Absolutely. And I buried the lead here, which is my fault. But the TechCrunch headline is anti-AI sentiment gets big applause at South by Southwest as movie maker dubs AI cheerleading as, quote, terrifying bullshit. And if you're thinking to yourself, oh my gosh, this podcast is anti-AI, we're just reporting what people are saying out there in the marketplace, because I do think in our little world of talking to founders and venture capitalists, the AI perspective has a single tilt to it, which is yay and hype. And so it's interesting to see what happens out in the world amongst the more, I don't know, creative classes, if you will, and their relatively contrarian view to what is kind of standard thinking in Silicon Valley writ large. I wonder if people who are building AI are listening to people who are opposed to what they're doing and are going to give them any time of day.
You know, I doubt it.
Yeah.
But they should, because I was just talking to a VC yesterday about the potential use of AI in video game development. And he was saying that a lot of developers are looking forward to it because it can kind of automate some of the more boring part of their tasks, especially video game developers that do like AAA games, like the really high quality, really heavy duty designing type of content. And so he was like, yeah, people love AI for that. Or they think they'll be like a great way to use AI. Someone mentioned bringing like generative AI into like non-playable characters. And like, there's a lot of stuff there. But then it's like the second you start talking about AI moving into like content or voices, or everyone's like, no. And it's like, I feel people should listen to those folks. It's such an underrated concept in venture. It's like startups can build solutions all they want, but if who they're selling them to doesn't want them, there's no point of building them. So people should take the feedback on sort of where people are willing to bring AI into the conversation and the places they really don't want to, so that people don't spend time building for an area that absolutely no one wants to buy in.
Yeah, I think the reason why I'm excited about AI in video games is actually the reason why I'm also not excited about AI in video games. I think I've mentioned on the show before that I'm a big Baldur's Gate 3 fan. And the reason why that game is so incredible is the sheer amount of amazing voice acting and the care with which the worlds were created and the diverse storylines that you can kind of weave your way through as you make choices and the motion capture and the sheer attention to detail that humans poured into it. It's amazing. It's just a great game. So I don't want to replace that with AI. I don't want to make cheaper games. But I do think is that AI, and you mentioned generative AI in the case of non-player characters, as a way to make games richer and deeper, that is exciting to me. So the idea, mm-hmm. I think, is what can we do better with this technology, not how can we use this tech to rip humans out of the process where they're already great. And I'm just worried that studio execs at the type of places that make AAA games, the biggest names out there, are going to see this as a cost savings measure versus a game enhancing approach. And that's distinct. But no matter what you and I think about this, startups are building. I have a couple of names for everybody. First on our list is a French startup called, I should have looked this up before the show. I'm going to go with Nijta, I think. Nijta. It's building technology that does kind of AI-powered speech anonymization, so that way you can comply with privacy requirements. And Nijta, if you don't know that word, not a huge shock. It's actually the Hindi word for privacy. And personally, my Hindi is atrocious, aka non-existent, so I didn't know that. It's a French startup founded by an Indian national who was in France, and he's building it there. So kind of another French AI startup in the mix for us. But I think it's kind of cool. I love the privacy focus.
I really like that concept too, because there is a lot of good use cases for this. This reminds me actually of a startup a little bit that we had on Found last summer. They're not doing the exact same thing, but they did stuff with like call center data. And I remember we asked the CEO about privacy and she was like, oh, well, all the voices are like anonymized. So it's like we can get the data, the exact same data. We can even hear how people say it, the inflection, the tone. And it's like, but we don't actually have to know who it is.
And that's literally what we're talking about here, because there are a lot of privacy rules in Europe. You may have heard of GDPR, for example. Elsewhere, there is a company called Tavis. It's a generative AI video startup, just raised $18 million, and it wants to bring voice and face cloning to any app. Started off as a SaaS service that allowed people to make like sales videos for people that were customized. And now they're offering up their tech via an API. Raised $6.1 million in a seed round last year. Scale VP led this round. Here's the thing. If you send me a generative AI video that is quote, unquote tailored for me, it just kind of feels lazy. It's my take here. I don't know. Am I being a hater?
No, I would guarantee this would freak me out.
I mean, I'm sure people are going to use it. I'm sure it's cool, but this one for me doesn't quite land. It's not something that I would want to have sent to me. But then again, I'm not a normie, so I'm not the target demographic here.
I have a feeling this is like my views on Cameo. Like people love getting cameos, and I think that's the bizarrest thing ever to like pay a random person and give them information about me so they can film themselves talking about me and send it to me. But people love Cameo. I've never understood that one either. So maybe this is the same boat.
I think there's something about having a parasocial relationship with somebody and then having them actually intersect with you that people find to be particularly tickling.
No, that's what I mean. Like, it's one of those things where I'm like, the use case makes sense to me on the one hand. It's just like, I am not going to be the target demographic for this.
Anyways, there are a number of other companies in this upcoming Y Combinator batch, the Winter 24 cohort, that are working on voice and AI. I was going back through the list just prepping for Demo Day in April, and I had noticed this trend, so I'm just going to throw out some names that kind of fit the voice AI realm. There is Marr Labs, that's M-A-R-R. There's Retail AI, Voice Panel, kinda, Toma, T-O-M-A, and then Yarn, again, kinda. So it does seem to me that we talk a lot about text-based AI and also video AI like Sora and so forth, but voice and AI is probably going to be just as big of a sector in time. So it's something to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Becca, you know that I love an S-1 filing. Nothing makes me happier than getting my hands on a fresh document from a cool company going to take on the public markets.
Who doesn't love an S-1 filing?
Well, everyone but us, actually.
That's true. It's actually, yeah, we're the only people who like them.
This is why we get along. But there's not going to be a lot of that coming. So I'm very curious what's going on with the secondary market and how does that help?
Definitely. It's funny to write this piece now because put out a story yesterday talking about why we're probably not actually going to see a lot of IPOs this year. The names people were really hoping to go public, things like Stripe, their recent secondary sale would prove, doesn't directly say they won't, but financially it wouldn't really make sense for them to have done the secondary sale if they were planning a upcoming IPO in the near future. Plaid recently on stage straight up said, nope, not this year.
God damn it,
Plaid. Databricks raising a huge primary round last year also kind of shows that it just wouldn't really, they're trading up on the secondary market. So I have a hard time believing they actually would. But people in a survey as recently as December, I surveyed about 40 different investors and everyone said they really did think IPOs would come back this year in some capacity. No one is thinking 2021 levels or anything like that. But the main reasoning people were giving is they're like, we have to find liquidity. Like the market needs liquidity. LPs are putting pressure on their GPs, which then put pressure on their startups. But that isn't the only way to get liquidity. And yes. So I think as much as people want IPOs to come back, I don't think they're going to this year because anyone who would be on that potential docket really to go public this year and have a successful IPO, key point to be making is anyone who's on the docket this year for a potentially successful IPO is going to have a lot better luck just selling on the secondary market and continuing to build their private valuation back up. Stripe is a great example of this because their recent secondary sale not only is going to appease investors, it's going to appease employees, it gave them a bump to their valuation from just even last year. It shows that Stripe can stay private and they can continue to grow their valuation. So if they went public now, they'd literally be leaving money on the table.
God, not really, because not all the stock sells in the IPO. They'd only sell a block of capital, or if they didn't just direct list, right? Like if you presume a direct list from a company that's as cash rich as many of these giants are, there's actually no money being left on the table. It's just them being cowards.
Oh, I mean investors. Like if you're an investor in Stripe and you see they can keep building their valuation, and if they went public now, you're going to make no money from it. One, you actually most likely have the right to block the IPO as a whole. But two, why wouldn't you wait? You can get the liquidity you need. You can go public, get the better exit. It just makes a lot of sense. And it's a positive thing. People have options. So like you can sell part of a stake. Like I was saying, Shasta Ventures, Bloomberg reported earlier this week that they hired Jefferies for a strip sale. And I was looking through their portfolio. Of course, it doesn't say like what stakes they're going to sell or not. But I mean, they're in Canva. They invested in the seed round of Canva, which is now estimated to be worth $40 billion, down from its last primary, but still $40 billion is nothing to snuff at. If they sold part of their stake in Canva, they could make a nice little return and they could keep some of their stake if they wanted, which is the beauty of the secondary market.
Okay, so first of all, I have missed you because I love hearing your perspective and I love screaming in my head, like, no, Becca, I don't agree. And the reason why I disagree in this case is your logic, well, very sound, does imply that VCs at the time of an IPO sell their stake in a company to send the money back to their investors. Not necessarily the case. Some return literal equity in a liquid public company instead of cash, or some VCs like to sit on their holdings even longer and have rules about that. So an IPO doesn't require VCs to exit. It just gives them the opportunity to, and therefore they wouldn't have to turn to far less liquid secondary markets, which have less information and therefore are price inefficient. And also these companies are reporting their goddamn numbers anyways. Every couple of quarters, Databricks calls me up and they're like, hey, guess what? We're bigger. And I'm like, hey, I'm shocked. And like Stripe just dropped some numbers the other day. They're like half public.
I know, but they don't have to be full public, and full public comes with some other things. And I know what you mean about the late stage investors, especially some of the groups that have sort of changed their delegations to over the last couple of years, firms making it easier for themselves to hold public stakes. But you know who isn't easy to hold public stakes? Pretty much everyone who invests before the Series C. So anyone who's been sitting in one of those companies for a long time, like the secondary market, they can even sell to the larger investors and then they get a return and the larger investors gets more stakes. It's like, it just seems, someone described it to me as like, it's the best of the public and the private markets. Like a good secondary deal means everybody's happy.
Except me.
Except you.
Except me, because I don't get an S1. And I'm my
secondary
favorite person.
Hater. I get it. No, I'm a secondary's deep lover. Passionate about the secondary market.
Well, I know that. I am too. I think that it's very cool that if you're a seed investor in a company that's 13 years old and your LPs are breathing down your neck, it's great that there is a way to get some liquidity from that stake and the success of that investment before the Collison brothers decide to finally pull the trigger. Great. But it doesn't really solve the issue of the big checks that bought the bigger stakes. It's going to be a lot harder to unload a massive stake in, say, Canva. Certainly there are exceptions. OpenAI, you could probably sell any amount of that stock at whatever price you wanted today. But most of the time, you can't really move that much capital through because it's a less liquid, smaller, more opaque market. Ah, I have an analogy. Do you watch women's college basketball?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Did you watch Iowa in the Big Ten tournament?
No, but I watched them all of last year in the March Madness.
Okay. Because my spouse is now a big college basketball fan, I did watch the Big Ten tournament, and they would say these hilarious things like, yeah, she's a sixth-year senior. And I'm like, yep. Excuse me, that is Stripe. Like, come on, either go to fucking grad school or just go into the workforce. Go public. It's not lethal. Do you know who grew after going public? Microsoft, Amazon, Apple. Alphabet. It's quite a list of companies. In fact, the biggest ones in tech managed to do this while public back in the day when it was actually harder to go public. So I'm sick of this delayed adolescence and failure to launch from these companies. Though I will say, congrats, there's a lot of secondary and you have some data about 2023.
Yeah. And I think the one key thing is that the majority of late stage investors can block an IPO. Yeah. And they won't have terms that directly say they can block an IPO, but they can have terms that say if it's going to go out at a lower valuation than they invested at, they can completely block it, which some cases companies are not going to wait. Like investors are not going to be crazy about certain things. But I can imagine if you're in Stripe, you'd be like, no, we could probably get close to that $90 billion if we have deep pockets, companies doing well, they're continuing to grow. There is no rush. And they're also, it's not even there is no rush. There may be people around the table literally preventing it from happening. They have a personal vendetta against you. You are hearing that correctly.
No one cares about me, and that's the way it should be. I don't matter. I just shout in my little corner. I have a lot more thoughts about what you just said, but we have to call it a day because we are out of time. But Becca, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. I always love having you on. Before we do our usual sign-off, though, tell people where they can find you and your work online.
Definitely. You can find me at yeoldreliable, aka techcrunch.com. I'm also on Twitter at Rebecca_Skutak, which has a silent Z in it. So definitely check your spelling. And you can also find me on Blue Sky.
Fantastic. And of course, we are Equity Pod over on X and Threads and TechCrunch Pods on TikTok. Also, just because I can't resist, happy 7th birthday to this show. Equity is 7 years old this week. I can't believe we've been doing this for 7 years. It's been an absolute pleasure and a treat to stick with the project. We're well into the 8 figures of downloads. And thank you all very much for sticking with us. It's been a journey. But to Chris and to Danny and to Katie and to Connie and to Lindley and to Kate and to Natasha and to Teresa and to Maggie, to Mary Ann, to who else has been part of the show historically. I guess Becca fits in that role as well. Kirsten's been huge. I'm missing somebody, I'm sure. But like, it's been an absolute laundry list of folks who have made this show happen. Henry as well. Can't forget Henry. He'll call me and scream. Just thank you for making this happen. It's the longest thing I've ever worked on apart from living itself. So, all right, that's us. Equity's back on Monday. Bye, everybody.
Equity is hosted by myself, editor-in-chief of TechCrunch Plus, Alex Wilhelm, and TechCrunch senior reporter, Mary Ann Azevedo. We are produced by Teresa Loconsolo with editing by Kel. Bryce Durbin is our illustrator, and a big thank you to the audience development team and Henry Picavet, who manages TechCrunch audio products. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.